I always appreciate it when the music complements the theme of the message. And I didn't give too much as far as what I was going to be talking about. I didn't give my points, I didn't give the title, but the little bit that I was able to give Leah was able to turn it into just something beautiful. And that one song, Behold Our God, I want to encourage all of you, go online, go somewhere and get that song for your MP3 player, for your computer, for on CD, I don't care. It's a wonderful, beautiful song. Up till now, I had really only heard it in Spanish. I'm a pastor, a youth pastor at a Spanish-speaking church in Indianapolis. And having heard it in Spanish, I really enjoyed it. Having actually gotten to experience it and sing it together with God's people was just such an amazing experience. I highly recommend you download that song. Last week, we introduced ourselves to Daniel chapter 1, looking at these Jewish young men who were taken from their home, brought into exile as captives, as hostages, and really assimilated into a foreign culture, a foreign religion. Their names were taken away from them, and they were given pagan names. Their future, their hope of being able to be leaders in their own society, were taken away from them. They lost access to God's holy temple, and they were forced to come to grips with the situation that they were in. And we saw how Daniel and his three friends decided not to defile themselves with the king's food, making a commitment to be faithful to God, even though it was not particularly convenient for them. We saw that God is sovereign over our lives, that He controls our circumstances, and that this exile that they had gone through, all these terrible things they had experienced, was actually part of God's plan to bring blessing to them and through them to the nation of the Jewish people. And we also saw how God was raising them up and giving them the skills and abilities that they needed in order to be servants, His servants, in a pagan government. It was just an amazing story of God's provision. And it just seemed that despite all the hardships, things just kept getting better and better for them. Well, by the time we get to chapter 3 of Daniel, things are about to get worse and worse. It is not easy to be a pilgrim in an unholy land, especially in a land where worship is directed at things rather than the Creator. And as we look at Daniel chapter 3, let us begin reading in verse 1. It says, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits and its breadth 6 cubits. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Then King Nebuchadnezzar sent to gather the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Then the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors, the treasurers, the justices, the magistrates, and all the officials of the provinces gathered for the dedication of the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. And the herald proclaimed aloud, You are commanded, O peoples, nations, and languages, that when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, you are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar has set up. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. Times are changing. When Daniel and his friends came to Babylon, there was no image in the plain of Dura. And in the time of their being there, Nebuchadnezzar goes and he builds this big statue of gold. And it is very likely related to this dream that he had had in Daniel chapter 2 that Daniel had interpreted for him. And in this dream, he had had the image of a man that was made out of gold at the head. And then lower down at the shoulders and in the chest area, it was silver. And as you went down the body, the metals went from being very precious and very valuable to being not as precious, not as valuable, finally ending with steel mixed with clay. And Nebuchadnezzar learned through the prophet Daniel that this meant that his kingdom was going to be the greatest of these kingdoms, this kingdom of gold, that he was the head. And likely, by his own arrogance, by his own pride, he decided to set this up and show the world that he had this golden kingdom. And he sets up this image and he calls all these people together to worship it. It said that this image was 60 cubits high and 6 cubits wide, which is about 90 feet high and 9 feet wide. A very impressive statue. It might have been an obelisk, like you see in ancient Egypt, one of those long columns, very narrow, not very wide, but very tall. It might have been just a statue of a human being, like sitting on a pedestal of some sort. We don't really know much about this image. We just know it was an image, and that he was calling all these people to worship it. From verse 2, we can see that this was a very big government function. This is a big to-do. Everybody who's anybody is going to be here. He calls the satraps, the prefects, and the governors, the counselors. The list goes on and on, and our mind can be boggled by who these people were and what they did. We don't need to focus on that. We just need to realize this was the thing to be at. This was like the New Year's Eve celebration in New York. This was kind of like the Super Bowl, where everybody is there. They're always commenting, who's this, who's that? They're all there. This is the thing to be at. The heads of all government bodies. And this is a demonstration of the power of Babylon. This is a calling for solidarity, to show your loyalty to the king and to the gods of Babylon. And he makes this proclamation. The herald comes out in verse 4, and he says this. He says, at the sound of all these instruments, you peoples, you nations, are to fall down and worship. You see, Nebuchadnezzar was taking people from all different countries to serve in his court. He was taking all these people to serve in his government. He was setting up puppet kings in other empires to serve him and advance his agenda in the Middle East. So he calls these people together, people of different faiths, different religions, different ethnic groups. We know that there are Jews there because we're going to see that in verse 8, what happens. And they're all told, worship this image. You'll hear all this music, instruments from all across the globe, instruments that these people easily could have identified with. And they are told, you will worship, or else you will be cast into a fiery furnace. Very likely the kilns that would have been nearby to fire up the bricks that would have served as the base of this statue, overlaid with gold. They had all the equipment necessary for building it. This is the end. We're dedicating this statue. We still have the tools setting out on the side, and we have these big furnaces. And anybody who doesn't worship will be tossed inside. And in verse 7, we see what everybody does. Therefore, as soon as all the peoples heard the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, all the peoples, nations, and languages fell down and worshipped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. They do what you would expect them to do, what Nebuchadnezzar expected them to do. They bowed down and worshipped. You see, the world demands our worship. The world demands our worship. No one is telling us to go outside and bow down before a 90-foot golden statue, but we face a daily call from the world, and not only from the world, but from our sinful nature that still dwells in us, to worship something other than God. We are threatened by the idols that the world sets up and that we set up in our own hearts. Because anything that usurps the place of God and takes His worship is an idol. This is not the concern of a bygone era. This is not the concern of the times before Christ, when nations were ruled by a king who claimed to have a special relationship with God. This is the concern of today. Because the world tells us to idolize autonomy. That is the American dream, is it not? Be autonomous. Be independent. Idolize yourself. Which is why we're seeing so much conflict today in American society over things like sex and sexual orientation. It's why we're seeing so much conflict over things like abortion. Because people want to be self-determinate. We're seeing people who want to be a different gender, people who want to be a different race, and they are going through the motions in order to make it appear that they are different than what they really are. We too, even if those are the things that don't tempt us, we still have this desire to be independent. Teenagers long for the day when they can move out on their own. All of us want to ensure that we are not up to our necks in debt. We are concerned about government pressing in on us and taking away our rights and our freedoms. That is a spirit of independence and a spirit of autonomy. It's not necessarily wrong, but it is something to be aware of. We want to control our own destiny. I don't know how many times I've heard this poem quoted in movies and on television and in the news media, that I am the captain of my soul, I am the master of my fate. It's like this is the desire of who we want to be. And we idolize ourselves. We are placing ourselves in the place of God. And this sin seeks glory for itself. Just as Nebuchadnezzar sought glory for himself, for his kingdom and what he had done, the sin that still remains in us seeks glory for yourself. We all desperately want to make ourselves gods. It was the original sin of Adam and Eve, and it is a sin that is just constantly begging to be satisfied. And like Pavlov's dogs who salivate when they hear a bell because they think dinner is coming, we hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, and the bagpipe, and every kind of music, and we fall down and we worship idols thinking they will make us happy. It is worth remembering that 1 John closes out in chapter 5, verse 21, with "Little children, keep yourselves from idols." This is not a concern just of Daniel's day and age. This is a concern of our day and age. And it's not just society, it's our own hearts that are pulling us away from God. Do you see the idols in your own heart? Do you see the idols that are constantly drawing you to worship them? We're all tempted in many ways. And if you don't realize that you're being tempted, chances are you're caving in without even knowing it. The story goes on, however, because when it says that all the peoples heard the sound of the horn and they all bowed down, there were a few exceptions. Verse 8, "Therefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. They declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that every man who hears the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. And so it is that these people come forth and slander the Jews. They slander Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And just like in Daniel chapter 1, where we look at the nation as a whole, and then we zoom in on Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and then we zoom in even further on Daniel, so too we see this accusation against the Jews. And then we zoom in even further on Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these Chaldeans, likely jealous, motivated probably solely by jealousy, not for any kind of religious fervor that they have, come forth and accuse these three men who Nebuchadnezzar had recently placed in charge of the affairs of the Babylonian area. They begin with flattery. O king, live forever. It's a pleasantry, but it's a necessary pleasantry when you're dealing with royalty who has the ability to execute you on the spot. But they start off puffing up Nebuchadnezzar's ego, which has already been blooming as he's been building this statue, not solely for the worship of gods, but to show the power of the Babylonian Empire and, by default, his own power by ruling it and creating it. And we see this command for the third time in so few verses about when they hear the music, everyone is to bow down. It's like this is getting very repetitive. There's a point. It's to show us just how central this idea is. And the accusation, look at this accusation. These men, O king, looking in verse 12, these men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up. You. This is so personal. It becomes a very personal issue for Nebuchadnezzar. And we see people attacked all the time. In today's society, not just in the news media, even in churches, you will see people attacked for taking a biblical stance, for holding to a biblical worldview. The world is terribly offended when we do not worship what they worship, when we call their gods idols. And Nebuchadnezzar himself gets hot, you might say. In verse 13, then Nebuchadnezzar, in furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said to them, "Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up? Now, if you are ready, when you hear the sound of the horn, pipe, lyre, trigon, harp, bagpipe, and every kind of music, to fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning, fiery furnace. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Nebuchadnezzar is hot. The whole concept of heat and wrath and anger are going to bubble up in this passage. One of the things that you'll notice, especially in the Old Testament, anger and wrath and heat are very closely related concepts. As a matter of fact, in many cases, they're the same word. When God gets angry, it talks about, sometimes you'll see it in the older translations about the nostrils and fire and that it's the idea of getting angry. You know, you get red-faced, red, the color of fire. Fire and anger and wrath and judgment are concepts that are so closely linked in the Bible. And so he flies into this furious rage, and he is anger, and his wrath is burning. And he calls these men. And it's almost like Nebuchadnezzar can't even believe it. You know, he's given this command, you are to worship. If you don't worship, you're going to be tossed into this furnace. He's not expecting anybody to disobey. And so when he calls them before him, he doesn't just pass judgment right then and there. He calls them before him and he says, is it true? He can't believe that they would actually disobey his commands. It is amazing to see how dumbfounded the world can be, especially as you see it in the media all the time, just how dumbfounded people can be that Christians believe the things that they believe and that they practice the things that they practice. I remember one time I went in college on a study abroad trip to Spain, and I was there with a bunch of students, college students from all over the country. We're enjoying the culture, we're learning the language, and one guy, I don't even know how this came up, but he said, you know, are you a Christian? And I said, yes, I am. He said, well, what do you believe about homosexuality? I thought, oh, great, I know where this is going to go. I said, well, you know, I'm a Christian. I believe that homosexuality is a sin. It is like other sexual sins. God doesn't approve of it. He doesn't approve of adultery. He doesn't approve of sex before marriage. He doesn't approve of homosexuality. This is a sin. This is something people need to repent of. God can save people. That's not the most offensive way that I could have put it. But you would think that I had said I'm a member of Westboro Baptist Church and I go protest soldiers' funerals with big signs that say God hates fags. You would think that's what I had said with the way this guy reacted to me. He could not believe that I actually believed that. He could not believe I would actually say that. It's like, you asked me. You know, I didn't just walk up to you and say, hey, let me tell you what I think about this. He asked me and he was totally offended. He could not believe it. And it's the same thing with Nebuchadnezzar. He cannot believe these people are not going to worship. And he kind of makes this generous offer, you might say. He realizes that they did not do this. And he says, okay, I'll tell you what, we're going to forget what happened. You have a new opportunity. When you hear the music, if you just bow down and worship, we'll all be good. We'll all be happy. But if you don't, you will be thrown into the fiery furnace. Maybe you didn't hear that part the first time around. Maybe you didn't hear it the first three times we mentioned it. We're up to number four now. And so he offers them, he gives them a way out, an easy chance of escape, and the world will give you so many chances to escape. How many times do you see politicians who have been on the chopping block for what they have said about abortion and homosexuality and all these other things, that as soon as they make the switch, all is forgiven? There have been so many things in the news about Democrat politicians and Republican politicians who at one point in time in their political lives came out opposed to same-sex marriage. And then they made the flip. And it's like we forget that they ever said anything against it. The world is so quick to forgive us if we'll just jump on board the train that they are riding. And in verse 15, Nebuchadnezzar makes the biggest mistake he could have made thus far in this chapter. He asks a question. And who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? Now, notwithstanding all the emphasis I'm going to give to these three men and what they did and the courage that they had, this is the absolute center point of this passage. It's about midway through, it's in the middle, and we will see its complement at the very end. This is the point of Daniel 3. Like I said, as important as what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego do, as important as what they say, this is the focal point of Daniel chapter 3. Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? I've been reading through the Old Testament. I've been in a Bible through the year plan this year. I like to alternate. One year I'll do the Bible in a year. The next year I do very close verse-by-verse study, and then I switch back and forth so I don't get too forgetful of what's been going on. It's nice to have the full picture. It's also nice to study the trees, you might say. And this year, as I've been working through the Bible, doing my necessary reading each day, I'm still in the Old Testament. The Old Testament is a humongous beast. The New Testament, you're over in like 3 months, and you're like, wow, what happened? The Old Testament takes a while to get through. And as you read through these stories, you begin to notice patterns. You begin to notice themes that keep popping up. And this question is one that you may have seen before. It's very similar to what the Pharaoh said to Moses in Exodus chapter 5, verse 2. It says, "But Pharaoh said, 'Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice and let Israel go?'" And if you know the story of the Exodus, he finds out in a very bad way who that Lord is. If you've read in 2 Kings or in the book of Isaiah, you hear about the Rabshakeh, who is kind of this emissary of the king of Assyria. And he comes before the walls of Jerusalem, and he is threatening them and trying to get them more or less to surrender and capitulate, much like they would later do to the king of Babylon. And he's kind of taunting them. And he says in 2 Kings 18, 33 through 35, "Has any of the gods of the nations ever delivered his land out of the hand of the king of Assyria? Where are the gods of Hamath and Arpad? Where are the gods of Sepharvaim, Hanna, and Iva? Have they delivered Samaria out of my hand? Who among all the gods of the lands have delivered their lands out of my hand, that the Lord should deliver Jerusalem out of my hand?" And before you know it, the army is completely decimated. Nebuchadnezzar, like Pharaoh and like the Rabshakeh, are about to get an education. This is the center of this passage. The answer to that question is vitally important. Verse 16, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, 'O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up.'" And so it is. The confrontation has been set. Like one of those old Western duels, they're standing out there and they know the terms of the engagement. Something is about to happen. And I love how they respond to him. "We have no need to answer you in this matter." I kind of puzzle over that phrase for a long while. What are they talking? What do they mean by "we have no need"? And I think it's because they're really saying, you really ought to know the answer to that question, Nebuchadnezzar. You've interviewed us. You've talked with us. You set us up with these great positions of authority and power. You had a dream that you couldn't understand and none of your wise men could interpret for you. And our buddy Daniel came forth and told you that our God was going to give you the interpretation of that dream. We don't really have any need to answer you because you should already know. Because in Daniel chapter 2, verse 47, Nebuchadnezzar himself said this. "The king answered and said to Daniel, 'Truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery.'" And so with the question that Nebuchadnezzar poses to them, "Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands?" Their answer is, "Our God. Our God is going to deliver us out of your hands." And they add this nice little phrase, they add this little "but if not" at the end. I love that. They're not too presumptuous. They're not going to write a check that God has to cash. He will deliver us. But even if he doesn't, know this, O king. We will not bow. You see, they were not motivated merely by a commandment. in the Old Testament to not worship other gods. Certainly, they had that in mind, but that's not the sole motivating factor for these people. They had an personal experience of God. They knew God. They knew who He was. They saw what He was doing in their lives, and they knew He alone was worthy of worship. And they felt, and they knew in their hearts, that worshiping God alone is more important than living. What is more important than living? We all answer that question in a number of ways. What is more important than living? We watch movies all the time. We read stories about it, of heroes and heroines who come out, and they reveal to us what is more important than living. I think that's part of the reason why I enjoy war movies so much. Because you see these guys who have endured so much together, and when the time comes for them to lay down their life, they do it. What is more important than living for you? Does worship even make it on your top 10? Worshiping God alone is more important than living. It's easy to say it. These guys had to back it up. And now we get to the fun part. Verse 19. Then Nebuchadnezzar was filled with fury. Now, if you thought he was mad before, he is hot now. And the expression of his face was changed against Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Have you ever seen the Lord of the Rings movies, The Fellowship of the Ring? There's this moment where this character who's been a steward, a faithful steward of this magical ring that corrupts whoever holds it. It's really one of those things you don't want to be responsible for, but if you have it, you're like, this is awesome. Because it's a powerful ring. It gives him the power to become invisible, which he uses multiple times. And he finally gives it up of his own free will. But it had corrupted him to a certain extent. And so he sees this other character who's holding the ring, and he's just, can I touch it? Can I just hold it for one last time? And the guy's like, no, I don't think I'm going to let you do that. And he is just sitting there, and then all of a sudden he goes, rah! And it just kind of scares you if you're a child. And his face just completely changes to something demonic. And you see this kind of happening with Nebuchadnezzar. His face was changed against Shadrach. You see the good cop, and now the little head spins around, and here comes bad cop. You know, he sets out the cup of coffee. He's like, here, have a cup of coffee. You can't have it. His face was changed against them. He ordered the furnace heated 7 times more than it was usually heated, and he ordered some of the mighty men of his army to bind Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and to cast them into the burning fiery furnace. Then these men were bound in their cloaks, their tunics, their hats, and their other garments, and they were thrown into the burning fiery furnace. Because the king's order was so urgent, and the furnace overheated, the flame of the fire killed those men who took up Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. And these 3 men, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, in case you didn't know who we were talking about, fell bound into the burning fiery furnace. Then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast 3 men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." Yeah? He answered and said, "But I see 4 men unbound walking in the midst of the fire, and they are not hurt. And the appearance of the 4th is like a son of the gods." Then Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace. He declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here." Then Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire. And the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair on their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. There and Back Again, a Jewish tale. Nebuchadnezzar orders that they carry out sentence immediately. And before they even have a chance to change their clothes, I mean, they've still got their hats on, their tunic, they're wearing everything, and they just bind them up and toss them in. They died with their boots on, except they didn't die. Nebuchadnezzar, for perhaps the third or fourth time in this passage, has an about face. Then King, verse 24, then King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He's astonished. He has more mood swings than a playground. And all this time, we hear about this statue, the image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up. The image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, that you have set up. And finally, you hear Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say, "We will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." And finally, we see Nebuchadnezzar set up himself. King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. It's the same word. He is the one who is finally set up. God has set him up, so to speak. And he is astonished. He sees, is my adding off? Did we not cast three men bound into the fire? Yeah, that's true. True that. And he answered and said, "But I see four men unbound." He's totally astonished. We threw in three, now there's four. They were supposed to be burned. They're walking around. They're not even tied up anymore. What happened to that? And the fourth one looks like a son of the gods. A lot of people like to comment about this as being an appearance of Christ in the Old Testament. That may be, I do not know. But that's not the point of this passage. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego certainly would not have known it was Christ. It could have certainly well been him, but they wouldn't have said, this is the Messiah, he's here with us. Be that as it may, we know that God was with him, with them, and they are saved. And Nebuchadnezzar comes to answer his own question. Shadrach, this is verse 26, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, servants of the Most High God, come out and come here. The question is answered by Nebuchadnezzar himself. He asks the question, they give him their answer, and he finally sees it himself. And this whole occurrence happens in broad daylight. It happens in public. We know this because we see here in verse 27, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, and the king's counselors, these are the people who were drawn here for this event, for this dedication, a moment to honor the king of Babylon, to recognize the power and supremacy of their empire. And here we see the opposite happening. We see the power and the glory of God on display for all to see in the most public way imaginable. He was hoping to set a public example, and in reality, he is the one who has made an example of. Notice that his men were not spared. The men who brought Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego up to the fiery furnace died because their gods could do nothing. And God spared Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now we move in to the meat. This is the best spot in this chapter. Verse 28, Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who has sent his angel and delivered his servants, who trusted in him and set aside the king's command and yielded up their bodies rather than serve and worship any god except their own. Therefore, I make a decree, any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb and their houses laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." Then the king promoted Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the province of Babylon. This is amazing. I love this story. This is not some fairy tale. This is not Aesop's fables. This is not to give us life lessons and make us feel good about ourselves. This is a true event recorded for our benefit. And we see a new decree. We saw the first decree. We saw it mentioned time and time and time again. And now we see this new decree. Nebuchadnezzar answered and said, "Blessed be the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego." You see, God is the focus of this decree. Nebuchadnezzar blesses God, not the men. He blesses God. And as much as we should focus on what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did, we should not lose the point. The point is about God. It's not about the men. It's not about you. It's not about me. The point, it's all about God. And Nebuchadnezzar realizes that God is the one to be blessed. Why? Because he delivered them. They didn't deliver themselves. God delivered them. And he blesses God because he alone is worthy to be worshipped, as evidenced by what the men did. It's not that what the men do makes God great. It's the fact that they realized he alone is worthy to be worshipped. So this decree is a response to his original decree. Look at who it is directed to. Any people, nation, or language. These are the people who are here witnessing this event, witnessing this dedication. These are the people who just moments before are bowing before this image. And the decree that was originally directed to all of them, he issues a new decree to all of them, to all the people in his empire. Listen up. Any people, nation, or language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb. Nebuchadnezzar was a creative guy. It seems like he tries to kill people in as many different ways possible as he can in this book. I mean, he's got fiery furnaces. He's willing to cut people's heads off, as we saw in chapter 1. He's talking about tearing people limb from limb. I mean, the Babylonians, they were kind of experimenting with every form of execution imaginable, it seems like. And don't forget, anybody who speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, don't forget, it was the Chaldeans in verse 8. At that time, certain Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews. It's kind of like when you're reading in the New Testament and Jesus tells a parable and the Pharisees get all angry because they realize he's really talking about them. This decree is really directed at those people, at the Chaldeans. I don't want to hear you saying nothing bad about these guys anymore. I don't want to hear you saying nothing bad about their God. Why? For there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. This is the definitive answer to the question posed in verse 15. It comes at the end of this chapter. The successful conclusion. And this is why we need to focus on this. Who is the God who will deliver you out of my hands? And Nebuchadnezzar realizes it and states it. There is no other God who is able to rescue in this way. God alone is worthy of our worship. The world demands our worship. The expectation is that we will live according to the world's desires. They want us to bow down before the idol of self, and that sinful nature in us is constantly agreeing with that philosophy. Let's do it! Worship yourself! No. God alone is worthy of our worship. Nebuchadnezzar even made an offer. He might have even said it was an offer they cannot refuse. But they could, and they did. He made an offer, and this offer is not unlike an offer that we see in the New Testament. In Matthew chapter 4, verses 8 through 10, It says, again, the devil took him, being Jesus, to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to them, he said to him, all these I will give you if you will fall down and worship me. It's the same kind of offer. Nebuchadnezzar says, I will give you your life if you worship this image. And the devil says, in a roundabout way, I will give you your life. You came here to die. I will give you everything you want. You're here to conquer. You are here to take and make a kingdom for yourself. I will give that to you. You can live. All you have to do is worship me. And verse 10 of Matthew chapter 4, Jesus said to him, be gone, Satan, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve. You see, that's how this story points to Jesus. Jesus says in the New Testament that everything in the Old Testament is pointing to him. You search the scriptures, but you don't even realize I am the one who they are testifying about. And you see that these men, like Jesus, saw that God alone is worthy of our worship. They faced death on that conviction. And they came out on the other side alive, just like Christ. But there are some very significant differences because Jesus is better. They faced death for a God who was worthy. Jesus faced death for sinners who weren't. They were saved from experiencing death. Jesus experienced death to save. They were elevated in Babylon. Jesus was elevated to the right hand of God. Jesus is the greater Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The question is, do you see him as worthy? Not just lip service, not just coming to church, not just putting on a smile for everybody else. Do you see Jesus alone as worthy of your worship? And are you willing to stand by that? Little children, keep yourselves from idols. 1 John 5:21, I encourage you to memorize that. There are so many idols out there calling for our worship, and we need to be on guard. And I want you to think, not just identifying with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, because the best one who can identify that with them is Jesus. They point forward to him. We're more like the rest of the people who are bowing down. We're more like Nebuchadnezzar. And think about the last time you got angry or upset. Think about the last time you were livid or frustrated about something and you got mad. Because that's what Nebuchadnezzar does. He gets so hot over this issue. Was your anger, was your frustration godly? Was it over something godly, and was it expressed in a godly way? Because Nebuchadnezzar's anger showed that he was elevating something above God in his life. Our anger can reveal our idols. And this is a calling to us. They serve as an example. And Jesus makes this promise that God will be with us, even to the end of the world. And we know that God rewards our faithfulness. They knew it. Even knowing that they could possibly die, but if not, they added that little exception clause in their statement there. They still trusted that God would reward them. Do you trust that God will reward you? That there is something even better than continuing to live? Praise Jesus. Praise God. Sing songs. Confess it to other people that He alone is worthy because He saved you. He experienced death on your behalf. And if you are here and you've been playing church, you've been playing Christian, you just go because it's what your parents took you to, or you just go because this is where your friends are at, and you have never come before Him, and you have never said, I worship you. I confess you as Lord. Turning away from your sin, I want to encourage you to respond to the gospel message that you too can be saved. God delivers. And that is part of the reason why He alone is worthy to be worshipped. Do not give in to the demands of the world. Do not give in to the demands of your heart. There are so many idols, but there is only one God. Let us pray. Father God, You alone are worthy of our worship. You are worthy, Master, Creator, Savior, Sustainer. You alone are worthy. And I pray, God, that we would all have that conviction, that we would be willing to sacrifice everything that we hold dear, if it means that we can worship You alone and we have that privilege and that honor of doing so. And God, I pray that we would see just how amazingly Christ embodies this story, how He went above and beyond, not just passing through the fire, but experiencing death on our behalf. And I pray, God, that as we realize that and as we see that, we would love Him all the more. May You alone be glorified, because You alone are worthy of all worship and praise. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.